ExchangeWire's ATS Singapore conference returns on July the 2nd, featuring the latest insights from an exceptional group of speakers highlighting future challenges and breakthroughs in media, marketing, and commerce. Visit exchangewire.com/events to get your ticket now. And for an exclusive 10% discount, use the code PODCAST10 at the checkout.
Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this week's Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Grainne Reid, ExchangeWire's Head of Marketing, and your host for today. Joining me are two of ExchangeWire's experts. We've got John Still, Head of Content. How's it going, John?
Good, yeah. Thanks very much for having me. Excited to get into some excellent stories this week.
Amazing. Alongside John, we've got Matt Broughton, Research Lead. Great to have you here, Matt.
Absolutely thrilled to be here as always as well. And yeah, looking forward to today's topics.
Excellent. Well, in this episode, we're going to dive into three major news stories that have been shaking up the industry this week. First, we have Group M, who have undergone a bold transformation, rebranding as WPP Media, with reports of an up to 45% of US staff. Then we're going to explore how economic uncertainty is weighing on media buyers, leading to expectations of a slower TV upfront season. Finally, we'll unpack why investors are putting their money into startups designed to help AI groups navigate copyright deals. Let's get into it. So, first off, it's been reported that up to 45% of US staff at Group M will be impacted by an organizational restructure at the agency, which will also reportedly see it rebranded to WPP Media. The reorganization will see the agency's media investment, Nexus, and campaign reporting divisions brought together under one umbrella, though it is unclear how layoffs or role changes are spread across these segments. Do you think we're going to see further consolidations across WPP and other agency groups, Matt?
So I think in terms of how the situation has developed, I think WPP has been unable to seize the narrative around commerce media, around AI, say like Publicis has been able to. So when Group M, which is its tech division, its darling in terms of that regard, when that lost the $700 million US Coca-Cola business, it was kind of like the writing was on the wall in terms of changes would have to be made. It was quite surprising to me that they'd been made this quickly. But equally, consolidations within agency groups and WPP specifically, they're not uncommon. We've seen the likes of Essence MediaCom come together. We've had JWT, which is now merged with VMR. Consolidations aren't that uncommon. So there'll probably potentially be some impact within the wider WPP business, particularly if they lose another big fish. But I think this move is mostly to kind of regain that momentum and seize that narrative again.
John, are you on the same wavelength as that?
Yeah, it's first off, I suppose a bit of a shame to be talking about this in the light of them having changes for 40 or 45% of their staff. They've said that they will be impacted. They've not said whether that is absolutely redundancies or whether that's changing roles, but we know there are going to be redundancies. I think that's fairly clear. And, we've already heard the stories about people being let go and with a couple of minutes notice in the States. So to frame it all, 40%, 45% redundancies or changes is hideous. That's an awful, awful for the personal cost for the agency. And that's a shame to see. So I'd love to be talking about a legacy agency rebranding and what that means and, the removal of the Group M titles changing to WPP Media. But yeah, the personal cost is sad to start with for me. I think, Matt, you talked about the writing on the wall being there with Coca-Cola. That was, that was a big deal for WPP. But then also Brian Lesser from Group M, he was talking at the end of February about the need for efficiency, the need to be an AI-driven agency. And I'm pretty sure that's when, if the writing was already on the wall, then it jumped right off the wall and became very, very physical at that point.
It was in permanent marker, but then they chiseled it into the wall.
I think, it's a start of that focus towards a new agency, holdco model driven by AI efficiency rather than large swathes and huge, bulky creative departments. So I think that's what Brian Lesser has in mind. And like I say, shame for the people who have worked there and given so much time. It's a shame as well to lose the Group M title if that does come to pass. But possibly the future of the holdco model.
Yeah. Well, I guess, like, do you actually think it will lead to greater efficiency and innovation, or could it actually lead to a bit of disruption in media planning and buying strategies?
Yeah, I mean, they'll probably pat themselves on the back and clap the immediate efficiency of, you know, removing of personnel who are doing these jobs and, you know, the AI workflows they can develop and stuff. I'm sure there'll be short-term pros, and in terms of the flexibility of how an agency works, I'm sure there'll be short-term gains for them. But it's early to be making such a huge play in that sense. Publicists have gone a very different way. They focused on data. We've seen with Epsilon that's been very successful for them. We've seen with the purchase of Lotame recently that they are all in on the data side of things, and that focus on AI. And this move seems a little early to be diving headfirst into a full-on AI-driven efficient agency. So yeah, I think short-term they'll see gains, but I'm not sure what the long-term cost will be.
Matt, what do you think the potential ripple effects will be for brands and advertisers that are working with them?
So I think in terms of it, you know, as John said, it remains to see how it'll play out. Some parts of the move, you know, would never want to advocate for layoffs, but some parts of the move do make sense in terms of merging the media, you know, media buying, media investment part of things in with reporting, because I think that makes sense to advertisers. They want to know, right, I'm spending. If reporting is really intrinsically linked with that, then that's going to bring some efficiencies there. But equally, you know, it remains to be seen how this, you know, organizational restructure, as they keep framing it as, how that will actually affect the advertisers day to day. I think, you know, in terms of the press releases and PR about it, it'll all go in terms of, you know, they'll follow the Mark Zuckerberg playbook of last year in terms of it's the year of efficiency. I reckon it'll be similar in terms of that regard, in terms of how publicly it comes out, how it all, you know, comes out behind the scenes. I think it's a wait and see in that regard.
Yeah, no, definitely. And what do you think this move means for agency holding groups? And I guess just the buy side as a whole.
Yeah, it's interesting because what AI has done, it has enabled these efficiencies and a kind of a new outlook. And the agency holdco model, it's, you know, we have huge holdcos that are tricky to be flexible with. I think there's a very long established agency models that is under threat from agencies, small independents that can work quicker, that can be more flexible, that can be a bit more nimble in what they do. And it's, you know, it's, I suppose it could be a similar story than legacy media having to shift in the advent of social media. You know, they were all of a sudden overtaken by smaller, faster moving competitors that could offer more quicker. And holdcos have become so large and so bulky that maybe it is time for a rethink. Maybe the holdco model is outdated and belongs to a past, very recent, but past time, and that this is a way of them now just reworking out how to compete in the new landscape.
What are your thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, I completely agree with John in that regard. And I think if you look at the holdcos over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, they haven't really grown in line with the rest of the industry. So in terms of, we've looked at our trackers this morning, big tech is up 161% since 2018, independent ad tech up 72%, publishers up 33%, and agencies, in terms of big holdcos, they're down 5%. It's not as if it's, you know, they've declined massively, but it's not as if they've exactly grown rapidly in line with the rest of the industry. So I completely agree with John in the sense that you've got these smaller independent agencies on the scene who have managed, you know, the more nascent areas such as commerce, media, AI. They've managed those new trends more effectively. And I think, you know, there's a lot that the holdcos can learn from those smaller agencies. We had the brilliant duo of Michelle Sarpong and Charlotte Powers on the podcast a couple of months ago. And I encourage anyone to listen to that episode to see how those agencies are really adapting, you know, really rapidly to these changes. Whereas, as John said, the big holdcos, they're a bit too cumbersome to be able to react as quickly to those changes.
I guess we'll definitely see and hear more about this in the coming days and weeks. But yeah, on that, we'll move on to our next story, which was DigiDay reports that marketers attending the TV Upfronts presentations in New York this week are likely to drag their feet during negotiations for major media commitments once the market starts to move. DigiDay spoke with six media buyers who said they would potentially be spending less this year and would be taking more time to consider where to put their ad dollars. John, how do you think this could impact TV publishers?
It's not a surprise, I don't think, that it would be a bit slower this year and that people are a bit more guarded with their spend. And also, you know, there's a lot of upfronts and it's a fairly fragmented marketplace. So there's a lot of choice and a lot of decisions to be made. So no surprise that this year in particular, given the turmoil that we've seen so far, people are being very guarded with their spend. Who knows when the next tariff will land? What will be the next industry that is massively tariffed? Will it be Hollywood? It's been cars. Who knows when it'll be TV? So I'm sure that's in a lot of people's minds before they decide on their hard-earned spend on where their ad money goes. But yeah, it is tricky. And the fragmentation is a really interesting piece for me. There's so many different places. And, you know, we've seen the upfronts from the big streamers and what's going on this week. And they, you know, put out their offerings. But there is so much to choose from. CTV is such a burgeoning market as well that there's a lot of choice for buyers. They're in a position of power, so they can, you know, drag heels a little bit and take longer and negotiate hard on their pricing. You know, we saw when Netflix came into the market for ads that they came in with incredibly high CPMs, and that, like what we've seen since, I'm sure in this particular landscape and this economic climate, they'll have to be a bit smarter and expect some pushback from the advertisers. So yeah, not surprised, but it's interesting nonetheless.
Matt, a shock to you or not?
I'd basically echo John's points there in terms of the economic uncertainty, and particularly around the tariffs. It kind of, you know, it affects everyone, buyers, sellers, whoever. But I think it, you know, in terms of the TV side of things, it's kind of a compound effect, because obviously, you know, when times get hard, advertisers pull their spend, especially on more expensive activations like TV, which obviously hits those TV publishers the hardest. Agreed that there's probably going to be a shift in those CPMs. I think there's going to be, like, the premium players will probably try and maintain it as much as possible, but otherwise there'll be a, you know, reduction in CPMs from those publishers which aren't necessarily seeing the spend in light. In line with what they want to see. I think there will be further growth in free ad supported TV. I think that's, you know, the trend over the past year and a half, that's, you know, grown massively. And I think that's only set to continue, especially if they're able to offer these more budget CPMs, but obviously offer TV inventory, which is obviously the, you know, still the gold standard. And yeah, fragmentation is such a huge issue. So I think those publishers should be looking to kind of, you know, bring that down and reduce that as much as possible. We've had a deep dive out recently, which covers fragmentation in the CTV landscape. And those advertisers are really, really facing, you know, major challenges with that. So yeah, anything that the publishers can do to bring that down can only be a good thing, and hopefully bring more budget their way.
Yeah, people should certainly download that deep dive immediately if they hadn't read it. I think it'd be, yeah, worthwhile background reading as we get through this episode.
We'll definitely put it on the podcast notes for people to download. So Jeff Green from the Trade Desk predicts a weaker upfronts for linear TV, but stronger programmatic and digital spending. Matt, what factors are driving this shift, and how should advertisers adjust their strategies in response?
I think the thing that's driving that shift predominantly is, you know, the overall trend in terms of everyone's shifting from linear towards CTV in terms of audience viewing habits. It's not necessarily linear's now gone. You know, it's taken a long, long, long time for CTV and, you know, internet connected streaming to surpass linear. There's some reports that suggest it has. There's some reports that suggest it's about to do so. So I think it's just that change in audience habits. What I would say is don't necessarily throw the baby out with the bathwater, in the sense that don't just stop linear. Obviously, connected TV, it's a huge opportunity and it shows great promise, but there's a hell of a lot of, you know, valuable audiences still watching linear. So I think striking the balance, work out what works best for your brand, and then go from there, in terms of rather than going, oh yeah, everyone's now on CTV, everyone else is now doing CTV, let's do CTV, work out what works best for your brand and go from there.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it was reported that sports will be robust and everything else will come down. So coverage of the NFL, college football, NBA and NASCAR were being major sources of appeal for broadcasting networks. John, how do you think advertisers can best capitalise on this opportunity, the live sports side?
Yeah, I think we ran a piece last year calling sports the last bastion of linear TV. It's where people have traditionally gone to watch their sports and where, you know, it's had a home. It's where sports has grown and but streamers are taking it. It is being parceled up in new and exciting ways for new audiences, and it's going to be, I think, a big part of the streaming success story is that they've managed to adopt live sports. I know Netflix they had the NFL Christmas games, which were a big success for them. Whether it's a sport or not, I'm not sure, but they've also invested in WWE, which has been massive for them. I mean, that is now live streamed twice a week in the UK as well. I think they still only have one of the shows in the US, but that would be for me like one of the big proving grounds for the adoption of streaming if they can take sports and attract advertisers to that. And it's a no-brainer. Amazon have gone for NBA. I think it's, if they can use the tech and use their kind of innovation around it as well, I think that'll be a really strong proposition for streamers.
Matt, anything to add to the live sports side?
So not so much in terms of live sports. I completely agree with John that it has been, you know, such a bastion for TV advertisers. I think, you know, for those brands which can't necessarily afford those live and premium placements, a lot of the streamers in particular, they've been rolling out lots and lots of sports related content, you know, Drive to Survive on Netflix being one of the prime examples of that. The test on Amazon Prime, a couple of other shows. But they've basically been rolling out more and more sports-related content. So I think that's a good opportunity for advertisers who, like I say, can't necessarily afford the live placements. And even for those that can, to kind of, you know, really, you know, back up what they've done in terms of those live sports placements. So there's plenty of options there for advertisers. And again, you know, in terms of the fast side of things, there's going to be sports-related options there as well to consider. There's options for advertisers, and I think sports is, you know, undoubtedly going to be one of the categories that will be most resilient in these turbulent times.
Do you think that we're witnessing a fundamental shift in how upfronts are being negotiated? So with greater demand for flexibility, are advertisers going to move away from the long-term commitments in favour of scatter buying and programmatic solutions?
I think in terms of the noises that have come out in terms of the upfronts, again, I think it'll be a wait and see. I think the overall trend may shift, but I don't think it's going to be a case of this year everyone's going to go for these more bespoke pass and parcel deals. Otherwise, I think, you know, in terms of running these big upfront events, everyone's still trying to lock in those long-term commitments, those long-term buys. I think the trend may shift, but it's not going to be an instant. 2025 is going to be the year of the smaller bespoke packages.
John, what do you think?
Yeah, I can see the shift. I think it's, you know, we've talked a little bit before about the agency model and how that moves, and also kind of TV advertising will probably have to move as well. In the sports sphere, you know, you would lock in having your brand on Fox Sports coverage of the NFL for a season, two seasons, three seasons, and you know who your audience were. But now that's all, it's all spread and it's all across different platforms, and advertisers are going to be wanting a more pick and choose approach, and they can get involved programmatically. It's the way to do it, and CTV's opening up in that way, so they could have, you know, placements near some Amazon NBA games, some Netflix NFL games, some WWE, and it's open there for them. So I think it's super attractive. Agree with Matt, won't be a sea change overnight, and they'll still be locking in those big deals because it's still a legacy audience. Linear still exists, as much as we talk about it. Like, it's it's not. But no, I think we are entering a new era of advertising as much as we are streaming entertainment.
Investors are backing a crop of startups helping the creative industry sell content to AI groups. Groups such as Pip Labs and Vermilio are building tools and marketplaces where writers, publishers, music studios and movie makers can be paid for allowing their content to be used for AI training purposes. Data reveals that these content licensings and data marketplace startups have secured $215 million, which is the equivalent of £162 million, in funding since 2022. Matt, how positive is this for the creative industries? Is this a genuine move towards creatives being properly compensated for their work?
It's positive, but to me, it's still like the best of a bad option. You know, you've still got the UK government still pursuing relaxation of its copyright laws to allow AI scrapers more free rein over, writers, artists, musicians, you know, creative content that should be protected. Donald Trump has just fired the head of the US Copyright Office after they just released a report, you know, criticizing the AI firms over their use of copyrighted material. Without these fundamental controls and fundamental laws in place, it feels like fighting a forest fire with a single bucket of water. It is still a good thing that these firms are getting funding. It's just not enough in my eyes. And obviously, you know, picking out ProRata as an example, it's valued at $130 million now following deals with the likes of DMG Media, Sky News and The Guardian, which is good. Obviously, they're helping these established publishers. But ultimately, if the copyright laws aren't protecting the smaller, you know, aren't protecting these established publishers, then what chance do smaller independent creators have against these AI streamers when they're, you know, A, not powerful enough to directly take action against the AI firms, and they're not lucrative enough to appeal to these, you know, newer AI firms that want to work well with the publishers. But so yeah, it's good, but it's also not great.
John, I know you've got a strong opinion on this.
Always on AI and copyright. I'll try and come at it from a couple of angles. One is, like, it is good. I agreed with Matt here. It is good in with a very small g, good, that there is going to be some money coming to creators and that they are fighting for this and that, you know, creators can be remunerated for what they're doing. But yeah, it's very much like very tiny good. I don't want to see the industry get to the point where they just sort of give up and get as little as they can from the AI giants because they have to, because it's that or be steamrolled. We talked a lot last year about license or litigate as the two choices. Basically, you can take the money from the AI firms, have your, you know, content bank scraped for eternity, but have a fairly lucrative deal with them, or you can try and take them to court and be held up for years and watch as the AI wave washes over you in the meantime. It is good. I'm trying to steel myself and say that this is a good thing and be positive, because, you know, that it's good to see those kind of steps and that we are talking about people being paid for their content, which is incredibly important across all industries. Hours, incredibly important to journalists, incredibly important to musicians, to any creative, to have some financial control over their work and it not just be like steamrolled by the platforms. My cynicism is overriding me here and saying that this is like, they'll just pay as little as possible or else they'll take it and it'll never, nothing will become of it. Too conflicting. They're not conflicting. I am the cynical one. I am just trying to be nice. Fair play for trying, and it's good to see things being done, and it's good to see. I mean, it's great to see the challenges to the government's AI copyright law. It's great to see people standing up in Parliament and saying, like, you cannot treat the creative industries like they bring so much to the UK, such a backbone of the UK. And it's hard to see that. It's nice to see something being done, but hopefully more will be done. And at the moment, it's piecemeal.
Yeah. So we've seen OpenAI and Perplexity already making 20 plus licensing deals. John, you've kind of already answered this question in a way, but do you think this shows that AI companies are genuinely committing to fair compensation? I say fair, we already know it's not. Or is it just a way to, for them to try and avoid regulatory scrutiny?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think Matt had a really salient point there before, in that it is, you know, great for the Guardians of the world and for the, you know, the large media groups to be able to strike these deals with OpenAI, and for OpenAI to be able, and Perplexity, not just OpenAI, to be able to say that I, you know, we are doing this. Look, we're paying creators. Wonderful. But like, it is not, you know, it's not them who'll be hurt the most. It's the small independent creators that rely on their individuality and their, you know, freelance writers who are being gobbled up by the machine. So it's, yeah, it is a way to appease regulators and to show that they are willing to do deals. But beneath it all is, yeah, though it is still siphoning away more creativity than just what mainstream media and the large deals that it's doing are offering and the money they're giving to it.
Matt, you're echoing it.
Yeah, completely agree with that. Like, you know, if you're gonna, you know, if you're an AI firm and you're going to go through these licensing deals, why not do it with everyone whose data you're taking? Obviously, they'd argue, oh, that's far too complex in terms of the size of our databases. But yeah, the databases you've got and the material you've trained your AI on, whether or not it's still in the system or not, if you trained it on that, then you should still be paying the creators for their work, whether that's a massive media conglomerate or the individual writer with a blog. You've got to pay them fairly for their work.
What downsides do you see to these AI licensing marketplaces?
So I think it's kind of analogous to the SPO conversations we have in ad tech. It's great that these, you know, platforms and technologies are coming to the forefront, but equally you need to ensure that those technologies and services don't become either too onerous to use or too expensive for, you know, publishers, creators, to be able to use those effectively. Because otherwise it's a case of, you know, to take PitLab's blockchain as an example, it's a very solid idea in theory to register intellectual property on that blockchain, but everything outside that blockchain is still not being covered. So it's a case of, you don't want publishers to have to sign up to every single AI platform on the market. Out, you know, as we've just discussed in the last story, these publishers are going through heavy economic uncertainty. They're not necessarily sure when the advertising budgets are coming in, and now we're expecting them to go, oh yeah, go to every single AI platform and ask for a deal. It should be more on the AI firms. And I think, coming back to my earlier point, the copyright laws should be more robust to make sure that those AI firms do properly do that.
John, finish this story. What, on a negative note?
I'll try not to. No, it's good to see, and it's nice that these things are beginning to exist and that a problem has been recognized and that people are offering a way for creators to get paid for their content. And that is good. That is, you know, very worthy, and hopefully will do some good in the long term as the AI wave. But it's again placing the onus on people to defend themselves, not putting regulation in place for the onus being on the companies that are taking the data. It's saying, oh, you left that there open. It's Matt, we do this every time. We should probably have someone really positive about AI to come and talk to us.
Just the two saltiest people on AI and or Elon Musk. And
yeah,
just,
we're like those two old Muppets that heckle everyone. when it gets to AI. But no, it's telling people that they should have defended themselves rather than putting the onus on the person taking from them to not take from them. So that's, yeah. Nope, I tried it. I tried to be good, but the cynicism has ridden out. Sorry.
Yeah, no, thanks for trying. And yeah, we know everyone needs to fight harder for more, for what they're producing and providing. Yeah. Grace, well, I think we can leave it there for today.
Well, thank you both for joining me today. Great discussion. John, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, G. Tried to be positive, failed miserably. Looking forward to trying again next week.
Excellent. Yeah, love it. And Matt, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks, G. Yes, similarly ranty as ever from my side of things, but that's how the cookie crumbles, I guess.
It's been a week. Well, yeah, that's it for the MadTech podcast this week, and thank you all for tuning in.
You've been listening to the MadTech podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.